most people don't know, and also Mormons don't know this either, that he was a treasure digging con man before he became a prophet. Like, there's literal proof, it's right there, that he just made something up and turned it into scripture.
I'm starting to feel like you think he was a charlatan.
He absolutely was.
What are some of the stories? Like, what are some of the more egregious stories?
I mean, you want to, we can go dark. It's pretty dark.
I don't want to get demonetized.
Okay, I'll try to use.
I'd like to still make some money on this video.
I was born and raised in Utah. So in the middle of all of the Mormons, yeah. Pretty much in the middle of nowhere. I wasn't even in Salt Lake. I was further north, closer to Idaho. So it was a very, very small town, is a small town. And I would say, at least from what I gathered, context clues, 80% Mormon. So everyone just kind of lived it. No one asked any questions. And I didn't really question my faith that much until I moved out of Utah and everyone started asking me all these crazy questions and I didn't have the answers to it. So that's when I really started discovering that it had some history that was very questionable. And for a while I was like, you know what? I'm still not ready to process this because it was so dark. I mean, the thing that I learned was about a temple ceremony that they had taken out, but my mom could have practiced it if she went to the temple a little bit earlier, which is like the super secret society thing. You can't just go if you're Mormon, where they would pretend to slit their throat and cut out their bowels if they were to reveal the secrets of the temple, which is all based in Freemasonry. The guy who started the Mormon church, Joseph Smith, became a Mason, a Freemason, and basically just plagiarized all of their rituals and secret handshakes and signs and symbols and made it into the Mormon temple ceremony. So when I learned that, it was a little too traumatic for me to completely disregard my faith or to dive into it even more, because I was also only 17, about to go to college. So, I mean, the shelf was getting heavier and heavier, as we would say as ex-Mormons. Just put it on the shelf and just, you know, just keep putting those things that don't make sense over there. And then eventually you have to deal with it when the shelf breaks. So that's kind of what happened to me.
Okay. So, I mean, where were you when you left? Were you in college?
Yeah, so I was in Vegas. I went to school in Vegas for fashion design. And I would say the super cringy things like, well, do you know there's more Mormons in Vegas than in Utah because they have to balance out the sin? And it was like really cringy and embarrassing, when in reality, Mormons just settled Utah before the mafia came in and took over. So there was actually a pretty big population of LDS people there, and LDS, short for Latter-day Saints. And I had a good time in the singles ward. I mean, they split up those who are between 18 and 30 who are single and put them in church together to try and get them to marry each other. So it's a very, it's kind of awkward, but it's fun because you're finally allowed to date. And before, it was very taboo, or, you know, completely shut off your sexuality or your romanticism. But as soon as you graduate, it's like, it's go time. You need to find your eternal companion. So there was a lot of fun things, but also confusing things around that time.
Right. Well, I mean, I think lots of religions kind of do that. They like for you to, you know, you obviously there's less issues or friction in a marriage if you both have certain things in common, and, you know, religion is one of them. So, you know, I can see, like, being Catholic, you know, there were these lots of group activities with the boys and the girls where, you know, they're trying to kind of pair you up.
Yeah.
And then you have marriage in Catholicism, like, to get married in the Catholic Church, you have to go to marriage counseling. So you have a whole series of classes you have to take and pass before they'll allow you to be married, which, of course, one of the things is both of you have to be Catholic, or one of you needs to convert to Catholicism.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, similar. It's similar in Mormonism. They don't say you have to be Mormon. Like, they're not going to deny you getting married, but they will deny you getting married in the temple, because even if you're both Mormon, there's a chance that you won't be worthy enough to get married in the temple. And that's the highest of high goals, because you can only get to the top level of heaven. I don't know if you're familiar with the levels of heaven in Mormonism.
No.
But there's lots of them.
Okay.
So there's a celestial kingdom, which is the top one, and then the terrestrial, and then the telestial kingdom. And they all have varying rules. And, like, they say that Hitler and the murderers and whoremongers and liars go to the bottom one. And then the middle one is for people who are, maybe they were Mormon and they just didn't follow all the rules, or maybe they were great people and they just never heard of the gospel and they'll have a chance to accept it when they die. And then the celestial kingdom, those are like the top tier Mormons, the ones who followed all the rules, made sure they paid their tithing in full, 10% of their income, were going to the temple, doing temple ordinances. They got married in the temple or sealed in the temple to their families. It's very ritualistic, I would say. And then within the celestial kingdom, there's three levels within that. And I don't even know all the rules past that point because there's just too many to keep track of. So if you want to go to the highest level, you have to get married in the temple, which is basically you have to pay to play. Like, you have to pay your tithing. You have to go to church every Sunday. You have to go to the activities. You have to, usually you hold a calling, which is kind of an assignment, a volunteer position that is given to you where you have to, I don't know, lead the songs in church, or you have to keep track of the finances, or you're teaching a class, or whatever it is. They give you jobs to get you to come on Sunday, and lots of different rules. And then also, if your kids leave, your salvation could be at risk. I mean, it's pretty dicey, but there's a lot of things you have to follow. So basically, the goal is to get to the temple. So that's why you want to marry a Mormon, and why you need to find someone who is righteous, in air quotes, and worthy to go. So there's a lot of guilt and shame involved, because if you do anything outside of these rules, like let's say you slip up and you have premarital sex, or you even do something lesser than that, which was my case, oral sex, and they're like, no, you can't do that. You can't go to the temple for a year, and they punish you, and you can't take the sacrament, which is like communion in church every Sunday. So people look, you know, if you're in a singles ward and someone's not taking the bread and the water, it is water, not wine, because they don't drink, then they know that you've sinned. And it's really embarrassing because everyone is like, oh, she probably had sex, or she probably messed around with her boyfriend. So it's this public shaming element to it that makes the singles ward even more icky and cringy to be in.
Okay, so I know the basic story of John Smith, right?
Joseph Smith.
Sorry, like he found like some tablets, and what's the basic story, right? Like, weren't these tablets that were given to him by Jesus or God or something, and only he could read them? They were gold or something. They were plates or something. I mean,
you're onto it. Yeah, you're pretty much there. So. The story goes that when he was 14, there were all these religions popping up, which was true back in those days, like 1830s or something, maybe 1820 something. And he's in upstate New York, and he's like, I don't know which religion to join. I'm so conflicted, because he's reading his Bible and trying to be a good Christian kid or whatever. So he goes into the forest and he prays, and he's like, which religion do I join? And apparently God and Jesus descended from the sky. And they were like, hey, none of them are true. It's your job to restore the real truth upon the earth. And he was like, wow, cool. How do I do that?
A lot for a 14-year-old.
Yeah. So the funny thing about that, though, and I'll just like stop throughout the story, because there's some things that they don't tell you when you're Mormon, because it doesn't make them look good. So when people are looking from the outside in at Mormons going, you guys are idiots, how could you believe that? Just know that they only have part of the story, and they think that anything additional or any other information is anti-Mormon rhetoric or just ex-Mormon BS. So that story was actually written down multiple times. I think there's like, I'm going to get the number wrong, it's between like 8 and 12 different versions of the first vision. And the first vision is an integral part of the church. So the thing is, there's so many different versions of it, and they don't even use the first or the last. They just pick one in the middle and call it a day. And so that's one of the things that I found out when I was leaving. I was like, wait a second, he totally made that up. If there's all these versions, some of them have God and Jesus, some of them is just one, some of them it's an angel. It's just, it's so messy. And so anyways, first vision. Then there's an angel who comes to him and says, there's a testament of Jesus. It's buried in the hillside. And when you're ready, I'm going to tell you where to find it. And this goes on for years, where he waits, and then the angel comes back and is like, "We're not ready yet." And then, so by the time he gets the plates, he's older. I want to say in his 20s, maybe even 30s or something. I should know all these dates by now, but I try to forget. And so he goes and gets these plates that are supposed to be made of solid gold, which another thing they don't tell you is that it's pretty much virtually impossible. And if it were an actual ancient record of people in the Americas in ancient times, it never would have been etched in gold. It would have been way too heavy to carry. Like, there's all these things that don't match up, but they don't really talk about that stuff. So he gets these plates. Apparently, there are witnesses, as written in the Book of Mormon, which is what the plates are translated into. And the witnesses, though, most of them were either excommunicated. One of them disavowed Joseph Smith and followed a new prophet. Some of them said, "Well, I didn't actually see it with my eyes. I saw it with my spiritual eyes." So no one really actually saw the plates except Joseph. Right. So most people think now, well, he probably just put something together like tin and had it under a blanket, and people just assumed that they were under there and they were so sacred that no one else could look at them but Joseph. And that's how he supposedly translated it into the Book of Mormon, by putting his head into a hat with a seer stone. It sounds so wild. Every time I talk about this story, I'm like, gosh, it's embarrassing that I just thought this was true. But I was born into it. So, you know.
I was going to say, and I don't know that it's any more unreasonable than, you know,
other religious stories
or Judaism or even Catholicism. Like, you know, hey, we nailed this guy to a cross and he rose again 3 days later. And, you know, like he turned water into
wine,
and he's got a basket that the bread just won't stop coming. He's walking on water. I mean, there's lots of things that you just, especially when you're raised in it, you just take it for granted. Well, of course that's true. My parents believe it's true. Everybody I know believes it's true. That's obviously true. You don't question it.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of it too. When you look around in the congregation and you see really intelligent people like doctors and lawyers, and they're standing up and they're bearing their testimony about how this is the one true church, and they know Joseph Smith was a true prophet, you go, "Oh, well, I must be the problem if I don't feel that it's right."
Right.
So he translates this document with a rock in a hat. And that's another thing they don't tell you when you're Mormon. They've recently come out and were like, "Okay, I guess we have to tell them now that it's on the internet." And the prophet was like, the current prophet was putting his head into a hat. And he's like, "It's like a cell phone. You know, it's hard to see it when it's daytime, but if you put it in a dark place, it lights up." And it's just really cringy. So anyway, that's how he supposedly translated the Book of Mormon. And another shelf-breaking item for me that I found when I finally started looking into it was the Book of Abraham. So back in the day, there was a traveling mummy show coming through, and Joseph, having taken everyone's money, basically bankrupting people or telling them to take out loans and give it to him, he purchased a mummy, and in the sarcophagus was a script. And he was like, "Wow, this is amazing." And it was Egyptian, obviously. And he goes, "By the power of God, I will translate this." So he does his best, and that turns into the Book of Abraham. And since we have that, that's like an actual thing that we have, which, by the way, they tell Mormons that the plates were taken back to heaven conveniently. No one can look at them now and like, "Hey, let's cross-reference this now that we know about languages." They're nowhere to be found. So, but this is a tangible thing that they still had. And once they cracked Egyptologist, the church was like, "Oh my gosh, this is going to prove that Joseph was a true prophet." So they retranslate it. Has nothing to do. It's so completely opposite. It's
just
like
for soup.
It's a funerary text. It's like something that they always buried with these mummies. It was very normal, nothing awesome about it. It was just very basic. And so when I found that out, I was thinking, okay, well, if he made that up, he definitely made the rest up, because you can't, like, there's literal proof. It's right there that he just made something up and turned it into scripture.
I'm starting to feel like you think he was a charlatan.
He absolutely was.
Yeah, I'm getting that impression.
Absolutely. Well, that's the funny thing. Most people don't know, and also Mormons don't know this either, that he was a treasure digging con man before he became a prophet. He would take that little rock that I told you about and put his eye to it, or like, I don't know, meditate on it and be like, wow, guys, there's treasure over there. And if you pay me, I'll tell you where it is. And these farmers, these poor farmers who didn't have a lot of money, were like, oh yeah, that would really help me out if I had some treasure to sell. And so he would take them to this place. And at some point, he even did animal sacrifices over this ground. There's a story of him actually sacrificing a dog. It's really dark and sad. And they would do all these rituals. It's very occult-like. And people would be digging and digging and digging. And then they would get pretty far down. And they're like, Joe, where's the treasure? And he would be like, oh, you know what? The guardian of the treasure has taken it further into the earth, because you are not righteous enough or worthy enough to get it. And they'd be like, oh, bummer. Let's try again tomorrow. Yeah. And he was actually conning people. Like, no, they were just, yeah. I mean, eventually he was running from the law because it caught up to him and people were upset, clearly. And that's why he had to move so many times. And that's another thing most Mormons don't know, is that they weren't just so persecuted, right? It's something that we were taught as, oh, we were pushed out from place to place to place because we were so persecuted and we were living the truth, and Satan, the adversary, was just trying to get rid of Mormonism. No, he was breaking the law all over the place and trying to steal guys' young daughters and wives, and people were upset, and that's why they had to settle Utah, where no one was. Well, the Native Americans were there. They wiped out a bunch of them, took some of them as slaves too. It's like, it's so messy, the Mormon history, that when you really look into it, it's shocking.
Eventually the church is founded and he's got followers. I mean, it's not like, it, you know, obviously at some point he must have, you know, stepped back and said, hey, I've got a following here. I need to stop being a knucklehead. And I've got, you know, no, all the way till day he died.
He tried to run for president of the United States of America.
I didn't know that.
He was not giving up. He even had his own militia, which I believe, if the sources are correct, at one point was larger than the actual U.S. Army. He had people willing to fight and go to war for him. He was very charismatic. He had won over the hearts of many, many people, and he wasn't going to stop. The only reason he stopped was because he got killed. He was put in jail. Because he burned a printing press to the ground because they were printing things about his polygamy and all of the stuff he was doing. And they're like, hey, we need to warn the town what you're up to. He sent people to go burn it down, gets thrown in prison, a mob comes, and he gets shot and he dies. So now he's a martyr. And then the next guy who took over, Brigham Young, was way worse than Joseph Smith. And he's the one that took everyone to Utah.
Okay. But I mean, the church is clearly, it's doing well. Like, they've got a following.
I guess define well, because there were so many religions that
survived.
Were up.
It survived. It's outlasted many other religions.
And the only reason for that is because they isolated themselves in Utah. They were practicing polygamy, having 10, 12 children per woman. And they just built the church by having lots of kids. I mean, really, that's the only reason it survived. It's the only reason it survived is because they moved to where no one could tell them what to do, until eventually the government did come in and they're like, yeah, this is the United States. You can't practice polygamy. You're going to not be a state anymore. I mean, Brigham Young tried to say that he was the king of his own country. Like, he tried to make himself a monarch, and the government was like, no, bro, this is the United States. You don't own this land. And so they're the ones that made them stop practicing polygamy. They claimed it was divine revelation. And that's why you have so many breakoffs, because at that time, Joseph Smith had said, this is the law, and you have to practice polygamy to get into the highest level of heaven. It's a requirement. And so when they stopped practicing, a lot of people said, no, this is not what Joseph Smith intended. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that he was running the church. The Mormon church is not that old. It's like less than 200 years old. And so they're all thinking, well, if we're going to follow Mormonism, we need to follow the fundamentalist principles, which is where you get the breakoffs of the fundamentalist LDS, the FLDS, the Warren Jeffs, the Keep Sweet, Pray, and Obey group, where that leader got put into prison because of child sexual assault. So you have all these breakoffs of polygamy now that are extremely problematic. You have one group who actually practice blood atonement, something that Brigham Young put into place. Have you heard of blood atonement?
No.
Okay, so this is probably the worst teaching, in my opinion, because they're literally murdering people. So the doctrine goes that if someone doesn't repent for their sins and you want that person to go to heaven, the only way to ensure they get to heaven is to slit their throat and spill their blood on the ground to atone for their sins. So they're straight up offing people all over the place. It was a really, really bad time in Brigham Young's era. And then people got a hold of this doctrine because they started researching into the early prophets of the church. And they started doing this again in the 70s. So there's a documentary that just came out, Daughters of the Cult. That's about the LeBaron group, the ones who found this doctrine and said, this is what God wants, is us to kill for him and make sure they get to heaven. And they're killing women, children, just innocent people for really no reason. And also, if you've seen Under the Banner of Heaven on Netflix, I believe, great, great, great TV show. It's scripted, but it's all based on a true story. The same type of story.
Yeah, that seems like a bad idea. The polygamy thing, I'm, you know, questionable. No. I'm glad my wife.
No.
She would what? Say that again. Say it. Uh-huh. did you ever see, there was a series called Big Love.
Right. About a polygamous family. I never watched it. So I think most of those shows came out in Sister Wives around the time that I was living in Vegas. And I was trying to be blissfully ignorant. I was like, they're not Mormon. They claim they're Mormon, but they're really not. We don't practice polygamy. I just wasn't aware that they were following the fundamentals of the origins of the church so closely that they were more Mormon than I was. And so I never watched them. I was like, I refuse. But I do know that they exist.
Yeah, it was a good show. But, you know, it was also, you know, Hollywood. It was entertainment. So at what point do you kind of go this, you know, you're saying, you know, as these things were coming out and you were starting to go, this doesn't really make sense. And if he made up this, then he probably made up this too. You know what I'm saying? Let's face it. Once you start lying, like, you know, it all starts to unravel. So, I mean, at what point do you separate yourself and say, hey, you know what? I'm probably going to need to get out of here, step out of this. And how does that happen? And what do you say to your parents? Because I'm assuming your parents are devout.
Mm-hmm. How does that go? So it really all just came down to feeling extremely worthless and lowest that I could possibly hit. It was rock bottom for me. So I was one of those people in the singles ward. I was 19. I had been dating another Mormon for a year. I was convinced we were going to get married. I was ready to do the Mormon housewife thing. I mean, I had my goals and dreams. I wanted to come to LA, which made it. And I wanted to be an actor and do all these things. And at the same time, I was dealing with, well, you need to get married young and you need to have lots of kids because that's how they groom you. That's how they raise you when you're in the Mormon church. That is your purpose as a woman. And so I found this worthy Mormon guy and we had this whole thing going and I was like, okay, this is my future husband. And I was still a virgin, but he was like, come on, let's mess around a little bit. And convinces me to give him a blowjob. And I was like, are you sure? Because this is a serious thing. You know, that's very against the rules. You're not even supposed to lay down and kiss in Mormonism before marriage. And so he's like, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. So we do it immediately after.
There's a loophole.
Yeah. I mean, it's really not, but kind of. Yes. I thought it was. You'll see in a second. It wasn't. So afterwards, he's like, you know, we should really go talk to the bishop about this. And I was so upset. I was like, eye roll. Are you kidding? really, like, I wouldn't have done it if you were, if I knew you were going to make me go and sit in the bishop's office and talk to him about this, because that is a very, very prevalent thing in Mormonism. You start talking to the bishop from 8 years old till you die. It's part of it, is you have to go in and confess your sins with a grown man alone in a room. You have to tell him all of your sexual stories. It's really awful and intrusive. Gross. Intrusive. Yeah. And exposing and unnecessary. And I would argue child abuse when you have these young girls talking to adult men about how they touch themselves. It's really wrong. Anyway, so obviously I didn't want to do it. But if he goes in and he outs me, then I have to go in. So when I did, I mean, I walk in, my head held really low and just, you know, I'm sorry, Bishop, I did this thing. And he's nice about it at first. And then he was like, okay, Shalice, well, that's going to be, let's do a year without going to the temple. And let's do a few months of not taking the sacrament. And I was like, what? I was so upset because I knew from other people in previous stories that the punishment for having sex was a year out of the temple. And this is a big deal also because your salvation is at stake. Because if I can't go to the temple, if I can't be in good graces, I'm no longer the A-plus Mormon student that I thought I was. I could end up in the Middle Kingdom and not see my family ever again. So I was very upset. And I'm like, what do you mean? I thought that that was the punishment for actual sex. And he was like, oh, no, Shalice, oral sex is sex. And I was like, it's not, though. Pretty sure it's not. Pretty sure I would have had a way better time if I had done the real thing. And maybe I should have, if the punishment's going to be the same. I was like, I'm still a virgin. That should count for something. And he just looked at me and kind of like, I'm not impressed. And I was so upset. And I questioned his authority and I was like, aren't you supposed to pray about it? Because we were taught that bishops, the head of the congregation, which by the way, they're not trained clergymen or anything. They're just random dudes who are in the church who get called to this position of power. They could be a dentist. They could be a plumber. They could be anybody. And now they are in charge of your salvation and giving you these punishments for God. And so we're taught that even though they're just regular people, that they have a direct connection to God. And so when you mess up, you will go and tell them, and then they pray for you and they say, okay, God thinks that you should do X, Y, and Z. So I told him that. I was like, what happened to the whole praying about it thing? And he did not like that at all. He was like, oh, are you questioning my authority? Yeah, kind of, because I don't think that that's a fair punishment. And then he lays into how oral sex is unnatural, how it's nowhere in the Bible, which I found out later it is, how it's just wrong and gross and dirty. And I was like, it's just kissing on another part of the body. And he's like, absolutely not, Shalice. It's much more serious. And if you know anything about the Mormon rules, some of the prophets have said that sex, premarital sex, is a sin next to murder. So now he's basically saying that I'm just one step below a murderer. And I'm just this 19-year-old who loves her boyfriend and wants to marry him and is getting punished for this, something that's so normal. And so eventually I just caved and I was like, okay. And he's like, maybe you just need to do a little better. Maybe you need to work on your spirituality. I don't think you're spiritual enough. I think you should break up with your boyfriend because you're a bad influence. Just blame, blame, blame. All on me. I know you work on Sundays, which is against the rules. Maybe you should look for a new job. Starts attacking my character. And so I just felt like, well, what am I even doing? I thought I was being a good Mormon. I still hadn't drank alcohol, never tried weed or cigarettes, never drank coffee or tea. Those are rules too. The only rules I was breaking was wearing tank tops and shorts, which in Vegas, I mean, come on, it's so hot. But that was immodest. Like, this shirt is even immodest because, you know, it's too low. But I was following all the rules, and here he is telling me that I'm a horrible person. So I just broke down in tears, called my mom. She was so upset. She was just like, are you kidding me? I can't believe he said that to you. And I think because of her support, I started thinking, wait, maybe the problem isn't me. Maybe it's the church. And that's the first time I ever allowed myself to think that. And that's when I started diving into Google with an open mind, willing to find information because I'm like, wait, my friend back in Oregon who had an intervention with me in her car telling me I'm going to hell if I don't follow her version of Christianity. Maybe she was onto something. Maybe I should check into this. Maybe I should really do some Googling and find out if there's any truth to this, because maybe there's a chance that I don't have to feel like a horrible person because I didn't believe that I was deep down. But I have this old dude being like, you're horrible and you need to repent and whatever. So I probably spent 8 hours on my computer all through the night till the sun came up, printing out things, highlighting things. And I did take it to one of the higher councilmen. So there's a guy under the bishop, first counselor. I wasn't going back to the bishop because I hated that guy. But I did take it to him and I was like, hey, what about all of this stuff? What do I do with this information?
Probably didn't work out well.
You know what? This guy, so he was a lawyer, incredible human being. We all loved him. He was so kind. He was one of those that fit in to the kid. Like, he was cool with the youth, but he didn't have to try to be cool. Everyone just liked him. And that's why I went to him, because I'm like, okay, he's gonna tell it to me straight. And he honestly was just like, yeah, those are all really great questions, but we just don't have the answers. And the way he said it, though, made me think that he knew all of that already, but he just didn't want to be the one to tell me about it. Like, it made me think that maybe he also had an issue with all of that, but he wasn't ready to leave the church, or he didn't really believe it anymore, but he was just going to stick it out because he wanted to be there for the kids, you know, like he's just a good guy. And so, and I say kids, but we're adults. So anyway, I take all that to my mom and I'm like, Mom, what are all these answers? Like, have you heard about the Book of Abraham translation? Have you heard about the multiple first vision accounts? Have you heard about Joseph Smith having 14-year-old wives and marrying mother-daughter combos and sister combos? And like, have you heard about any of this? And she's like, no, she was completely in the dark. Because she also grew up in Utah and her parents were Mormon and their parents were Mormon. We like, our lineage goes back to literally the first Mormons. And so she took those questions to her bishop and then the guy above him and the guy, she couldn't get any answers. And so I unknowingly set her on a path to deconstruction. So we're kind of figuring it out on our own. And it's at one point she calls me on the phone and she's like, hey, Shalise, I want to let you know, it's her and my dad together. I want to let you know that we haven't really been going to the church and are going to church. And we took off our garments. Those they call people who are non-Mormon call them magic underwear. You've probably seen them. They're like clothes you have to wear under your clothes if you go to the temple. And it's a really big deal to take them off. So she's like, we took off our garments and just want to let you know what's going on. But if you want to get married in the temple, we'll do whatever it takes to be there. I found out later, like a few weeks ago, that she meant she would just lie to get a temple recommend so she could go to my wedding. Cause if she wasn't worthy, she wouldn't have been able to go to my wedding.
Right.
And I was like, oh, no, it's fine. I'm actually out of the church, or like, I don't believe it anymore. And she was so relieved. She's like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy, because she was worried that I was going to disown her, because that happens. Families are torn apart when someone says they no longer believe it, because they teach you to ostracize them or love them enough to bring them back to the Lord. So she was really happy. So I thankfully didn't have to deal with getting cut off from any of my immediate family.
Right. Kind of like the Aaron thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know his story, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I've interviewed him before on our channel.
Yeah. Yeah. They put pressure, you know, on his family to basically say, can't have anything to do with it. But I mean, it was overboard.
So sad.
Yeah. I don't get alienating yourself from people that, you know, aren't a member of the church. Like, I don't think that does the church any good at all. And yeah. Like, not just that, but like him, his wife, like their child, their grandchildren, like, what are you doing? Like, it's too much. It's overkill.
Yeah. It's really sad.
Super controlling too. But, so your parents were no longer, they were still going to church?
So my parents were not going to church because they had started to dig into everything that I was telling them and they realized, oh, wow, yeah, it's all made up and we shouldn't be doing this. And this is not what we want to be doing anymore. And so they were distancing themselves. But I think to their family, they still had to pretend like they were Mormon, put on their garments or wear clothes that wouldn't show they weren't wearing their garments around them.
Right.
Because getting ostracized is a real thing. And I've known people personally who their parents say, "You're dead to us. We don't want anything to do with you." It's really sad.
Do, you know, if 80% of the town is Mormon, like does the Mormon church kind of put out like a notice like, "Hey, this, you know, these people work here or they own this business. Like, don't, you know, you, let's say your dad owns a carpet cleaning business. Like, don't work with him anymore. Don't have him clean your carpets. Don't have him."
Is right.
Does that happen or no? They just shrug it off. So, like, "Oh, lost a couple."
It's tricky because it really just depends on where you are. And it depends on the members. Some members are very, very strict in their beliefs and it's like very black and white. And I don't think the church itself would send out a notice saying, "Don't interact with these people." I could be wrong. Maybe it's happened before, but it's a lot more subtle. It's more gossipy. So once the word gets around, it may just happen naturally where you lose part of your business. So I did have on a couple who they were speaking out about child sex abuse in their ward. Apparently the church was protecting the predator and not notifying anyone else in the church that he was going to church with them and their children and being around their children. And so they spoke out and they were like, "Why aren't you doing anything about this? Why aren't you telling people what's going on?" And they ended up losing a lot of their clients because it really makes no sense. It's so backwards. But if you speak out and the church punishes you in any sort of visible way, like taking away your calling or not allowing you to take the sacrament or disfellowshipping you, which means you can't give prayers in any sort of church capacity or hold callings, then the members will start to distance themselves. Maybe the church doesn't say, "Hey, don't do business with them," but the members just know, like, I should probably stay away. I don't want to get infected with their sins. So right. People just kind of do it naturally.
Okay. So what happened with the boyfriend?
Well, he did break up with me for a hot second. I think we got back together maybe a month later, and then we were following these stupid, cringy rules. And he came home with a sheet of paper and he was like, "Okay, this is what Bishop gave me. This is what we're supposed to do or not supposed to do." And it was a list of things like, "Don't be with each other after midnight," or "Don't allow anyone of the opposite sex to go into your bedroom," or "Don't lay down and kiss," and all these. And I'm like, "Dude, we've been dating for a year and you're going to tell me not to do this stuff now? This is so pedestrian. Like, are we in middle school? What is this?" And I was really petty about it. I remember he was doing laundry and he walks into his room and I stop at the door and he's like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "I can't come in your bedroom." And then that night we were watching a movie and I looked at the clock and I just got up and was about to leave. And he's like, "Don't you want to finish the movie?" I was like, "Absolutely. I would love to finish the movie, but it's midnight and I got to go home." And so that was teenage me being a brat about it. And then eventually we broke up. I mean, it wasn't meant to be. And I'm so glad that I didn't go down that path because my life would have been so different. He literally admitted to me later that it's like, "Yeah, I know you had plans to go to LA and be an actress and all of this stuff, but I was just planning on marrying you and making you a housewife."
Right. I mean, he had an agenda, you know. Yeah. You had an agenda. He had an agenda. It was,
he had a Mormon agenda. And yeah. That's what he was taught.
But you're in LA now.
I am. So I did move to LA. I did become an actor. I did get married just recently, about a year ago, and just now pregnant with my first child. And I could not be happier that I waited this long. This was definitely the right move for me.
And you run a podcast. Is it a YouTube podcast or is it?
It is. Yeah. So we have a YouTube channel. My husband and I both do it together where I interview survivors of cults. We talk about their stories, platform, everything that's going on with these different cults that people don't realize. So we do talk to Scientologists. We talk to Amish people. I would say the Amish stories are probably some of the most shocking because you would not expect it. And we really just allow people to tell their stories and get exposure on these groups. So it's called Cults to Consciousness.
So what are some of the stories? Like, what are some of the more egregious stories?
Oh man. I mean, we can go dark. It's pretty dark.
I don't want to get demonetized.
Okay. I'll try to use,
I'd like to still make some money on this video.
Yeah. We have to struggle with that all the time. So let's just say that the more strict any religious group is, it seems the more abuse follows, because it creates a predator's paradise where the predators are slapped on the wrist. Don't do it again. Oh, everyone forgives them. If you talk about it, then you're in sin. So with the Amish, for example, let's say an older man abuses his own daughter, and they find out about it, and the victim is usually punished worse than the perpetrator. And the punishment would be, they call it the shunning, or put in the bon or the ban, depending on who you talk to, where they can't eat with their families. They can't even eat out of the same bowl as their family. So they're really isolated for about 6 weeks if you're the predator. And sometimes the ban can last years if you're the victim. And a lot of times it's because they think it's the victim's fault. So what was she doing? Was she walking improperly? So they teach you how to walk so you don't draw attention to yourself.
You're sure that 12 or 13-year-old girl that seduced a 45-year-old man.
Really? No, honestly, even younger than that. So
I don't know if you know anything about my story. I was in prison for 13 years.
Yeah.
And 40 per, about, let's say, between 30 to 50% of the people at one of the prisons I was at were convicted, you know, sex offenders. Mm. And mentally, their minds are so warped that if you have a conversation about them, they will tell you like, well, you know, she seduced me. You know, she knew, she's 12. Like, what are you talking about? You're a grown man. I don't care what she said or what she did, assuming that you're telling the truth. I don't care what she said. You're a 45-year-old man. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's happened so much in the Amish communities where you're not even allowed to have your hair down, or wet hair is too sexy. They don't even tell, in some cases, because I will say this is not a blanket statement on all Amish communities. They do have their own individual rules, and some are more strict than others. So in one of them, we were speaking to someone who, it's like the old order Amish, very, very strict. He wasn't even allowed to know what pregnancy was, but they're having 10, 12 kids. And so when his mom would get pregnant, he would say, "Hey, why is mom's belly swelling up?" And his dad would say, "She has the sickness." And then one day there would be baby brother, and he's like, "Oh, we have a baby. Where'd that come from? We were blessed with a baby." They literally don't even know where babies come from, and they're not allowed to know to that extent how reproduction works. And then within all of that, because it's so intense, the purity culture, and so demonized, even just the female body, they're telling these men, we read it in one of these booklets on one of my interviews. They're telling boys, "Well, don't look into your sister's room at night because she may tempt you while she's asleep." And so it's putting these thoughts into these kids' heads like, "Oh, am I supposed to be attracted to my sister?" And that happens. This incest happens where they are being assaulted by their own siblings and they were doing nothing but sleeping, or maybe they weren't wearing their full gown that they were supposed to be wearing. Maybe their hair was draped over the side of the bed. And so they're blamed for it, and they were sleeping.
Right.
So it's so clear to me that the more strict the purity culture is in any given religion or any given group, the more distortion, the more perversion, the more abuse happens.
Right. Yeah, I can definitely see that. I can see that, you know, it's, and there are certain, you know, well, I mean, that's a lot of groups though, you know, like in the, you know, with Catholic priests. I'm not saying all Catholic priests are, you know, have an issue, but it, you will end up getting people that think, "Hey, this is a good environment for me. I'm in a position of power and trust." And then if something happens, then they just move me to another congregation, mm-hmm. you know, like you've got people looking out for you. So it just, you become more and more emboldened by it. Like, hey, this happened. They found out about it. Nothing really happened with me. I had to go to counseling for a few months and then I went to another parish. It's worth
it. That's it.
Right.
Exactly. So, yeah. And that's what I meant to bring up before. And then I got sidetracked within the Amish specifically. Once the ban is over, they go up in front of the church and they say their apologies. And then everyone has to say whether they believe that they are repentant or not. But I've asked the women, I'm like, what if you don't think that they've repented or that they're actually sorry? And they're like, it doesn't matter. You have to agree. Because if you disagree, then you're going to be punished in some way. So the congregation says, yes, we agree. He is sorry and he's not going to do it again. So anyone who talks about the offense afterward, the victim, maybe it's the mother of the victim, anyone who brings it up to say, hey, my kid's not okay, they get punished because they're supposed to have forgiven the person. And then the predator just does it again. And then they put him in the ban again. And then he goes up and says he's sorry. And they have to forgive him. And it's just this ongoing cycle because there really isn't a punishment that is great enough to get them to stop.
What, so mostly you're saying it's mostly the, you're saying the Amish are some of the worst.
Some of the worst as far as the abuse goes and the secretive, like everything behind closed doors. I mean, they're having sex with animals. It's really, it gets really dark. And aside from that, I would say Children of God, where they were openly having sex with kids because they said it's God's love and we have to share God's love. And it was the opposite of purity culture in a very, very destructive way. So we've had people from Children of God come on and tell their stories, and those are really dark.
Children of God?
It's just a religion.
Right. How? I mean, is it a large religion? Is it 50 people or is it 500? Is it?
No, thousands.
Oh, okay.
So this happened, I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, where this guy, I think he was actually part of the Moonies at one point. I could be wrong. But he eventually was like, you know what? I want to be a prophet instead of shaming everyone for sex. It was during the free love movement. Let's talk about how God loves sex and that it's society who's been demonizing it this whole time. And sex is beautiful, which I can agree. Sex is beautiful. It can be. But he said, we need to share God's love, and God's love is sex. And so he would bring people in under this impression of, you know, we're teaching God's word, God's true word. And then the sex stuff started slowly getting worse and worse and worse. Now they're offending children. And now they literally wrote a book of how to do it. And it was with one of his own sons. The leader, the cult leader's son, was being abused from infancy. And they have photos of it. And they're like, this is how you sexually liberate children. And they had to stop eventually because they were getting raided so often. Eventually, people were finding out, sending people into the compounds. They're being raided. But even so, it was forced polyamory within the adults. So they said, okay, we can't have sex with kids anymore. We have to wait till they're like 14. But once they hit that age, it's like, okay, well, at 14 to 18, they can have sex with each other, but just not the adults. Once they're 18, then it's, or 16, I think, it depended on the rules of the country or the state that you were in. But once that limit was hit, then they were expected to go share their love with poor brother so-and-so who's feeling sad today and he needs someone to lift his spirit. So why don't you go share God's love?
Wow. I've never heard that one. That's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you've had people on the podcast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we did one with Daniela Messineck Young. She's written a whole book about it. Highly recommend it. I think it's called Uncultured. And she talks about her time growing up in Brazil because they basically scattered outside of the States because they knew they couldn't get away with it in the States.
Right.
So they went to Asia. They were in places in China, in Russia, Brazil, South America, and they would just traffic people around. So if you did something wrong, they could just send your kids away or send you away and not allow you to speak to them. So she was raised in Brazil. She talks about how, I mean, she has her own traumatic stories that she puts in the book and then comes to the US, fights her way through school, tries to get an education because they're also not educating the kids, and makes it through college, joins the army, and then realizes, oh my gosh, this is also like a cult, but I can do this because I'm a pro at handling high control groups, and how that affected her. So we've had her on. We've had another guy on who was from, I can't remember, somewhere in Europe. And he talks about what it was like being a boy in this group and how he tried to escape many times, ended up homeless for like 20 years, trying to just make it through life because of what he went through. There's a lot of really inspirational stories that we've found come out of this horrific group.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're not educating these kids, then I don't know how they can, how they, where can they go to, you know, to survive? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like they're going to go, like, if you can't fill out a job application, you're not getting a job at Walmart or Pizza Hut or, you know, any entry level position, even. Like, you're really not mm-hmm. capable of getting at finding a house and saving money, opening a bank account, you know, assuming you can even get a driver's license if you're leaving and you don't have a birth certificate or. So,
A lot of them don't. A lot of them don't have documentation. A lot of people in the Amish don't have birth certificates, don't have a social security card. They have religious exemption from all of that. And so they aren't required to have it. So when they leave, they don't exist according to the government. And so even just trying to get that is a huge step.
Right. Or even if they disappeared, nobody's looking. There's never been a social security number or birth certificate. Who are you looking for? Mm-hmm. Jimmy, met him twice at 7-Eleven. He doesn't come in anymore. Well, I don't know who Jimmy is. So, I was going to say there, I remember there was a thing, camera call where, I don't know if it was David Koresh was doing it, where it's they called it Bleeding the Beast. Mm-hmm. Where, do you know what I'm talking about? Where they would go and women would apply for food stamps and they would apply for all these government subsidies and they would just hand over all the money. So you're not contributing to, you know, the government. You're not abiding by, you know, the laws, but you're bleeding them of everything they can give you for the call. And then these women aren't even getting the subsidies that they're getting. They're not getting the food stamps. They're not getting the money. They're not getting housing. Anything that's coming in, it's all going to the cult leaders.
Yep, that's exactly right. I've seen that in many cases, many of the stories that people come on and tell.
What was it I had heard about? And I never did mention this to Aaron. I should have mentioned this to him, where I had heard that in Scientology, that they would have these guys run up their credit cards, you know, like they would, so let's say you're getting older, you're retiring, and then, but you have perfect credit, and they would just have them run up, you know, their credit cards to pay for all kinds of different things, knowing you can't pay it, but it doesn't matter anyway. You're close to the end of your life. You own your house. You don't need any of these things. So why not run up $100,000 worth of debt, hand it over to, and stop paying, claim bankruptcy, and collect Social Security. You know, you're in a position to do that. But you know, there was just all these ways that they had, like, these scams that were semi-legal almost, you know? It was like, it's an issue.
Yeah. Or how about the doomsday religions? We were kind of talking about it earlier, like Jehovah's Witnesses. I've interviewed people who their parents were like, well, first of all, college is pointless and you shouldn't go. But second of all, the world's going to end anyway, any day. So there's literally no point. And any so day. Talking to
it's been a while. It's been a
talking
while.
Talking to people who were saying, yeah, I didn't plan for my future. I didn't have any savings. I didn't even pick an occupation because I was planning on the world ending because they told me it was about to end. So what's the point? That's also a very bleak place to be in.
Yeah, there's always those fringe cult groups that, like, the Halley's Comet is coming, and, you know, it's mm-hmm. behind the tail. There's a, you know, whatever. You know, it's going to hit, there's going to be an asteroid, or there's this, or there's that, or, you know, because of these planets are aligning and that's going to destroy the Earth. And it's amazing. Like, what happens when those things don't happen? It's kind of like the Heaven Gate thing is so over the top bizarre to me. Let's go get Nikes and matching jumpsuits.
Right.
And drink like poison Kool-Aid or whatever they drank.
It's so crazy. Did you ever meet any convicted cult leaders or people who did outrageous things in the name of their cult when you were in prison?
No, but I remember there was one guy that everybody was saying was going to prison. He had some kind of a cult thing where he was making these massive sweat lodges. And like somebody ended up dying. Like one of these guys got super, you know, hot and had a stroke and ended up dying. And so and this had happened a few times. They usually had paramedics that could bring them back, but like somebody, one or two people died or something. And so he went to trial, like that the government brought him to trial, and he was like, no, this is part of my religion. And they were like, listen, this has been happening. You knew this was an issue. You're putting these people in danger. And so he lost, and he was supposed to go to prison. He never showed up at where I was, but I always wondered like how interesting that would be for this guy to show up. Like, was he going to be in here trying to convince people to start a...
Yeah.
Who knows?
To follow him in there. Yeah. Cause I also wonder, we've seen a lot of the cult leaders who are convicted or even die or whatever. It seems like they all have these narcissistic tendencies and these personalities where they just completely lack empathy, don't care about anyone but themselves and power. So I was wondering if you'd run into guys like that in prison. It's no big deal.
But they're con men. They're not religious con men. They're not trying to use some kind of religion. They're just con men in general. You know, they see everybody as a mark. Yeah, there's tons of those guys. You know, there would be guys that would sell. There was a real estate guy. I won't mention his name because I think he does watch my channel sometimes. I'd love to get him on my channel because he was funny. He was interesting, but he was a black guy, you know, educated, smart. He was in real estate. He had done some real estate scams. And so all the black guys looked up to him because, you know, he's in there. He's not in there for selling, you know, drugs, which most of the black guys are in there for. Let's say 80% of the black guys, maybe 90%, if not fraud. He was there for, it was millions and millions of dollars. Like, he had some real knowledge, but they would come to him and give him business ideas. And he'd go, you know, what you need is a business plan. And he'd say, look, if, you know, for $200, I'll write one up for you. And he would write up these, but they were all basically identical. Like, he's literally swapping out four or five paragraphs with what they're saying, but well written. And he had somebody on the street that would get like data for whatever area they were in. And he'd say, yeah, listen, you know, a carpet cleaning business in your area, you know, based on what the medium house price is and how much, and somebody would look some stuff up. Like, there was maybe 4 or 5 hours, but $200 in prison is a lot of money. So these guys they're getting they're paying $200 and $300 for a 5-page business plan that took no more than a few hours to put together. If that, yeah.
Nobody caught on?
No, it was, you know, they were happy to pay. And, you know, none of these guys, like, people would ask me about it. You know, hey, would you write me up? I'm like, bro, you know, no, I'm not doing that. Well, you know, this guy's charging this much. And I'd go talk to him. Are you really charging? He'd be like, can you believe it? They're paying it too. And I'd say, God, bro, you know, this guy's not going to open a carpet cleaning business. This guy's not going to do this. This guy's not, you know. But it didn't matter. That's how he did his time. That's how he got money. But he was very charismatic.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there was lots of those guys there. You would talk to him. And I mean, you're sitting there knowing this guy stole like $40 million from his investors. And yet he's very credible. I'm ready to, if I had some money, I'd invest in him. Like, I'm ready to hand over money. He's
not good, huh?
He's good. I know you know, these guys are going to get out and make money.
Yeah.
You can't hold these guys down. And it's funny because guys, when I would sit there in prison before I got out and I would sit there and be like, I don't know how I'm going to make a living. They go, oh, bro, you're going to do great. You're going to make tons of money. I mean, you're a guy like you is always going to make money. I was thinking to myself, yeah, by committing fraud. Like, you guys think that because I had millions of dollars, like they're like, yeah, you've run a bunch of businesses. They were all based on fraud.
Uh-huh.
Like, the judge was very clear that I couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
So I can't do that. So now you're saying, oh yeah, but you could do it legally. If I could have done it legally,
I would
have committed fraud, you know, and I probably could have made a decent, a semi-decent living, you know, but it would have been way too hard. And at that time in my life, I was fundamentally lazy. Why would I work hard to make a semi-decent living when I can be lazy and make millions doing virtually nothing? That's just silly. That's the way to go. And that's what I thought, because I also thought, they're never going to catch me. Why? Because I'm just that good.
Uh-huh.
Because that's what arrogant narcissists think. They think, well, I'm just that good. You're not going to catch me.
Do then you consider yourself a narcissist?
I'm on the scale.
Okay.
I'm definitely on the scale. But the difference between me and most narcissists is that I'm okay admitting that. And I can see myself doing it now, where I start to manipulate someone and I'll tend to stop myself and go, are you saying that because you know that ultimately he's going to have to come back to you? Uh-huh. Like, are you making this recommendation because you know this guy's going to go off, find out he can't do it himself and have to come back to you? Because trust me, I'm extremely calculating. Like, I'll give you a plan and then send you off knowing he won't pull it off. He can't pull that off by himself. He's got to come back. And then sure enough, 2 weeks later, man, I was wondering if I could just pay you to, oh, well, I wasn't really thinking along those lines, but I guess you could, you know, oof, let me think about this.
Yeah.
Here's the payment schedule. You know, like, it's like, so yeah, I mean, I definitely see that, but I think that 95% of the con men that I've met in prison are in prison working on their next scam, whether they know it or not. And a lot of them don't even, the worst kind are the guys that don't even know it. Like, you're talking to them and you're like, you don't even realize you're a con man.
See, that's the thing. So that's what I was going to say. And I want you to continue, but I just was going to point out that the fact that you can see that you have narcissistic tendencies makes you not necessarily a narcissist to the extreme, because they have zero self-awareness. They just don't have any idea what they're doing is wrong.
Right.
Okay, continue.
I think there are two things that happen that kind of, well, maybe three things. One, I wrote a memoir, which is super difficult to do because you don't see you how you really are. Like, you don't see you the way other people see you. And two, I remember at some point, and this was really while I was reading books on how to write memoirs, and it just kind of dawned on me, like, you know, the person was trying to explain how to kind of step back out of yourself. And they didn't say it like this. This is my interpretation of it. They said, basically, they were like, if 50 people say you're an asshole, you're probably an asshole. They're not all wrong. So if 50 people say this is how you behave, and you can come up with an argument for every single one of those, there's 50 of them. They're right and you're wrong. So you need to start realizing, you need to accept the fact that you're wrong. And if you can accept the fact that they're right and you're wrong, you take a huge step toward seeing yourself the way you really are and not the way you perceive yourself. So that was like kind of opened my eyes. And then a friend of mine named Pete Rossini told me, and I've said this on 10 different episodes, his thing was, you cannot go to prison and behave the same way you did that led you to prison and expect to get out of prison and not come back.
Like,
you have an opportunity here. You were given a bunch of time. You can look at it, you know, two ways. Oh, this is horrible. You can bitch and moan the whole time you're there and everybody will hate you and you'll leave learning nothing. Or you can decide, I've been given a gift of time and I can do something with it and I can change. You know, how much I've changed is, I'm sure, up for debate, but in some ways I've definitely changed. I remember I was talking to my ex-wife one time, and I talked to her on the phone. And so we're talking, you know, I was in prison. I was like, so what's going on with, you know, so-and-so? She's like, oh, he's doing this. I was like, okay, well, what's going on with Nick? She's like, that's like her new husband. Oh, he, this happened and this and this. I go, okay. I go, whatever happened, you know, you told me about your sister. Like, is she still doing such and such? And she goes, what the hell's going on? And I go, what? She goes, you never ask me about,
oh wow,
about myself. What is happening right now? She goes, you've been doing this. You've been getting weird the last few times we talked.
And she's like, what's your motive?
Yeah. She was like, something's going on. I was like, yeah. I was just wondering because I was thinking, I knew I was supposed to call you today or you sent me, you know, and I was wondering if everything was okay with so-and-so. And she's like, no, I'm just checking on you. I'm like, okay, well, I was just wondering. She's like, you don't wonder about anybody but you. What's happening? I'm like, I don't know what's happening. I've been reading this book. And, you know, I started having those guys. Then she'd come see me and we'd talk and I'd ask her questions. She'd be like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever. So you know, you start to realize that if you make those subtle changes and people react like that, you do kind of start to realize like, wow, what an asshole.
Like, that's so interesting.
Being in a relationship with me is so one-sided. At least at that point in my life, it was up till prison and 5 years into prison, probably 5 years into prison, every relationship I ever had was 100% one-sided. I didn't know who you were. I didn't know anything about you. I didn't care anything about you. It was, what can you do to help me accomplish my agenda? You know, and look, I'm going to pay you. Like, I'll give you some money. If you need something, well, what do you want for this? Okay, well, I'll pay you for it. I don't have a problem with that. You know, like when you have stolen money, like I'm a big shot with Bank of America's money.
Yeah.
In Bank of America's money or SunTrust money or, you know, I'm, woo, you know, like, but yeah. So, I mean, it's not like you're not going to get paid, but you know, it's not because we're not friends. I really didn't have any friends. Even the people that were friends of mine, they weren't friends of mine. They were people that were pretending to be friends of mine because they were making money. Mm. And then you go to prison and when you have nothing to contribute to them, you realize, wow, you guys were never friends. I didn't have any friends and it's not their fault. You know, at first you blame them and then you kind of have to step back and go, no, that's my fault. I think you grow a lot when you start realizing that pretty much everything is your fault. You know,
this is so interesting because it brings up a really good point and I want your perspective on this because it seems like you can actually change someone who has narcissistic tendencies into someone who is more empathetic, which I didn't even think was possible, especially hearing all these stories of these cult leaders. So I'm wondering if these cult leaders were to be imprisoned, you think it's possible that they can completely change their ways or at least partially and come out a better person?
I think they would have to admit that. I think like I said, it depends on how high up the scale they are. And it depends on whether or not they want to admit that they're there for a reason. You have to understand almost every guy every con man that I've met in prison doesn't believe that they're there because of them. It's always someone else's fault. And it's so funny because you start talking to somebody about their case and it's not their fault and it's not this and it's not that. And then 6 months to a year later, it starts to come out. Well, I was using a fake name. Well, I did buy a shelf company that was 15 years old so that it appeared that the company had been around for 15 years and it wasn't a brand new company. Well, I did do this. Well, I did do that. Well, I did have them sign this and I did have them sign that. And I did, it's like, my God, within a year, you're like, you're such a scumbag, bro. And they're like, I know, I thought it would be fine. And you know, and then you break them down. But even still, I don't think most of them ever get to a point where they want to change. Right. And I just didn't want to come back to prison. Like, I just thought, you know, and I think that part of that, I think that's writing a book. That really is writing a book. It was about me, is that, you know, and you, it's funny too, because you realize when you write books about other people, because I've written a bunch of true crime books about other people, you start to realize they don't see themselves the way they are either, you know? And I remember the first time I read an article about me and they described me as a con man. I was so offended. I was like, I mean, wanted to call up the reporter. Who do you think you are? I'm not. But, you know, then when I went to prison, I read those articles again. I was like, why was I offended? I just ripped off the banks for $11.5 million on this one scam. You're a con man, bro.
Yeah.
And you use fake identities and synthetic identities and fake this and fake pay stubs and W-2s and fake appraisals. Like, what do you You're lucky they just called you, they didn't call you a scumbag. I mean, and you were offended that they said con man? What an idiot. Like, how delusional is that? That's like, you know, a woman who's charging men to have sex with her and getting offended when someone refers to her as a prostitute.
Right.
That's a polite way to say it. Like, what are you doing? And sitting there, you don't know me. You don't have any. Pretty simple. But that's really where I was. And that's how these guys are. And they don't want to change. And they're thinking I'd had discussions where guys are talking about changing their name. Because I'd legally changed someone's name one time. One time I stole someone's identity and then I went and legally had his name changed. Don't judge me. Don't
judge
me.
Oh my God.
I just wanted to see how to do it. And go through the process. It was like $1,500. It took a few weeks. Guys would be like, man, I heard you had someone's name changed once. And I go, right. And they go, how does that work? And so I talked to them about it. And then I said, well, why? Well, you know, because man, there's all these artists, all this stuff on the internet. I was thinking if I could change my name, you know, and it's like, you're just setting yourself up for another scam. Like, even if they said, you know, just rechange my life and, you know, get a regular job and maybe, you know, it's like, stop, bro. Like, I don't, you know, I was the only guy in prison that I knew that told everybody that if I was going to lean into it, I said, yeah, I'm not going to hide from it. I said, if it comes up in a conversation, I'm going to let everybody know I just got out of prison. I was in prison. Here's what I was in prison for. Here's what happened. I said, and they were like, yeah, but then people will walk away from you. They won't want to deal with you. They won't want. And I was like, well, look, then there will be two kinds of people in my life. Those that are 100% acceptant of the person I am and the things that I've done in the past. And those people that can go fuck themselves. I said, that's it. Yeah. And there's plenty of people. So I'm going to be okay with the left, with the ones that are okay with it. I said, because I'm not going to continue to lie the rest of my life, because that's the same behavior that got me into prison. You know,
right.
and I think that's part of what kind of made me go, I'm not doing this anymore. It's no good. I would be better off living in someone's spare room, you know, like making no money and living in someone's spare room, but just being like honest. That's a better life than the life I had before prison.
Well, absolutely. It's really admirable that you're willing to take that level of accountability, because I think that's part of it. Like you said, you have to admit to who you are and what you've done in order to live authentically and be yourself and not hide from it. That's a huge deal.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. I'm just trying to stay out of prison. I always like people that tell me like, I admire what you're doing and you're an inspiration. It's like, I'm just trying to stay out of prison, bro. Like, I'm not trying to inspire anyone. I just don't want to go back to prison. So I don't want to behave in a way that leads me back there.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, and it's not like people will say, you know, so you don't have those urges anymore to commit fraud or all the time I have those urges. Like, that didn't go away. I'm too old to go back to prison. And life is so good out here. People take things for granted. They really like life is so good. You have YouTube, you have Netflix, you have like, you know, it's just not a horrible place out here. You know, I hear people bitch and moan about stuff. And it's like, are you serious? Like, you have a car and a nice house and you have clothes and you can go eat whatever you want, whenever you want. And you can watch TV and you can go on vacation and, you know, like, life is amazing.
Yeah. You
know, so
it's a big perspective shift. And you interview people all the time who have been in similar situations or been in prison and are con men themselves. Do you find that they also have the same big perspective shifts, or does not everybody feel that way?
You know what I think? I think the people that come on my program do.
Yeah.
For the most part, there's some guys that are still like, they'll blame somebody else. They'll blame like the guy that told on them. It's like, okay, well,
no,
you were robbing banks.
Yeah.
It's like, you were robbing banks, bro. Yeah, but he didn't. Yeah, but maybe you shouldn't have given him the ammunition, because maybe you shouldn't have been robbing banks. Like, you know, oh, but it's his fault. How's it his fault? You were robbing the bank. Yeah, but he told on me. Like, you're an idiot. You know, if that's your argument, you haven't learned anything. So I'd say 90 to 95% of the people that I interview have had a shift, especially if they're willing to come on and talk about it.
Yeah.
If you're willing to come on and talk about it and lay yourself bare in front of the world, something's fundamentally changed in your thought process, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's not like I'm paying anybody. You know, there's no real benefit. Like sometimes they've written books, and maybe they have some kind of an agenda. But it's hard to write a book and not really kind of come to terms with who you are also.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think it's really encouraging to see that, at least for you, the prison system did create some sort of shift and it was beneficial. Or would you say it was beneficial?
No. Oh, yeah. And look, I needed to go to prison. Like, I was like, you'd meet somebody every once in a while where you'd hear their case and I'd research it and I'd kind of think, like, I have about two people that I researched their cases well. And really, it was like maybe I think you broke the law, but you probably should have gotten 3 years. But because you went to trial, you got 17. Or somebody else who it's like, you didn't break the law at all, but you're an asshole. You were an asshole to the DEA and to the prosecutors, and you were a greedy prick, but you shouldn't have to go to prison for that. Like, just because you're a jerk doesn't mean you go to prison. You know, maybe you don't have good communication skills. Maybe you have poor interpersonal relationships. Like that's its own set of problems. But it's not illegal. What you did wasn't illegal. You just went about it the wrong way. You got a bad prosecutor who also offered you a couple of years in prison. You didn't take it. You got 19 years. Because that's what happens a lot. It's like you'll be offered 3 or 4 years and you go, no. And it's like they're offering me 3 or 4 years and I didn't really do anything. I'm going to go to trial and win. You understand that if you lose, you're not getting 3 or 4 years. If you lose, they're going to put everything on you and you're going to do 15 or 20. And then they never think that. They never think, well, I didn't really do anything wrong. It doesn't look, if you're guilty, you've got 100% chance of being found guilty. If you're innocent, you got about a 50% chance of being found guilty. So if you're questionably innocent and you go to trial, it's a problem. That's a mistake. So I've met those guys and I've always walked away from those kind of research projects or guys I've written stories about and looked in their cases. And I've always been like thankful that I deserve to be there. Could you imagine you didn't really do anything?
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, I've seen that, like you didn't really do anything. Like I knew a guy that gave somebody money to open up a pain clinic. He didn't run the pain clinic, by the way. This was a friend of his brother's that knew he had made some money, came to him, said, could you invest? I'll give you 50% if you'll put up 50 grand. And he said, sure. So he gave him the 50 grand. No big deal. Guy opened, and it wasn't even initially for a pain clinic. It was for a FinFin clinic for people to lose weight. There was a product called FinFin. Well, it became illegal after about 2 years. And so they're halfway done with the clinic. You're not getting your money back and we can't open the clinic. But you know what? We've got a couple doctors that have already signed up to be doctors here. Let's go ahead and just do pain management. And the doctors were suggesting, hey, well, let's do pain management, which there was no such thing as pill mills at that time. This is in the very beginning. So he's like, yeah, sure. This guy lives in LA. The clinic was in Louisiana, New Orleans. They open one up. It does very well. They open a second one up. It does very well. This guy's calling every once in a while going, hey, how much did you guys bring in? Send me $3,000. Well, send me, you know, he's a jerk. He's a constant pain in the ass, right? And there were other things that he did that were just, you know, stupid things, but not illegal. Anyway, as a result, he ended up, when they eventually got busted, and he's never been there. Like, he didn't even, you know, they ended up indicting him. The pill mills are in his name. He ends up going to trial because he says, I didn't do anything. I gave somebody 50 grand. And sure enough, he goes to trial. His name almost never comes up. Almost never. They're talking about the doctors, the other guy, the partner, this guy, this doctor, this nurse, this person. And all they would say is, yeah, yeah, his name is Dennis Caroni. They go, Caroni? Well, he'd call like every 2 or 3 days and scream at us to send him some money. You know, he is absolutely a maniac. And they'd send him money and they'd say, they'd ask him questions. He'd be like, I don't care. Do whatever you got to do to keep the money coming in. Like, that's the kind of stupid stuff that he would say.
Right.
Not thinking it's illegal. And so he ends up going to trial. He gets 19 years.
Oh, wow.
They offered him like 3 or 4 years. He said, no, I'm not going to take 3 or 4 years. I didn't do anything wrong. I've never even been to the clinic. I didn't make any decision. Now, of course, they put off several of the decisions on him. While we asked him about it, he told us to do this. He's like, they didn't tell me to do anything, bro. I'm a maniac. I don't have any clue how to advertise for a clinic. I'm not a doctor. I'm not the manager. You know, I just know that they owed me money. They were constantly he felt they were screwing him out of money. So he's constantly yelling, I want to see the books. I want to see this. Send me, how many patients did you see? How many, you know, so they're like, this guy, every time he calls, he's screaming at us and yelling at us. And so they hated him. So it wasn't hard for the people that had been indicted to turn against him.
Yeah.
Could have taken 3 or 4 years.
Oh my gosh.
You know, like I said, at least when I interviewed someone like that, it was like, at least I was supposed to be there, you know? And it was just, to me, it was just like, how do I not come back? Because I do. I think about committing fraud all the time. How do I get out of here and not commit fraud anymore? Because every time my bank balance drops below, you know, 100 or 200 bucks, my first thought is, okay, I could do this and I could do this and I can do this. 2-3 weeks, I could have about $200,000. Then I could do this. Then I could do that. Then I could immediately, you know, it starts. So how do you cope with that? That's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that perspective. It's really interesting hearing from your side of things, because we talk about people who are or should be sent away, these cult leaders, and would it really work, or would there be any sort of transformation or reformation? And so it's really interesting to hear how it worked for you and your perspective.
I think it's a long shot. The biggest thing is they'd have to realize that most of these guys just don't want to, they don't want to admit that they're wrong in any way.
Yeah.
That's very narcissistic. It's like, oh, no, I didn't do anything wrong. I won't apologize and I didn't do anything wrong. It's like, oh, bro, like that's what you understand. That is fundamentally your problem. And most of the time that has been detrimental to their lives, but they don't want to admit it. It's always somebody else's problem. Somebody else's fault.
Yeah, they're just completely out of touch. Have you watched the documentary Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey on Netflix?
No.
Okay, so
on. Let me write it. I gotta write this down. Hold on.
Keep sweet, pray, and obey. It follows the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I never said that in the interview, by the way. That's the full name of the Mormon Church. They don't like to be called Mormon anymore. So anyways, it follows the FLDS. Warren Jeffs was the leader, the prophet. He married like 80-something girls. We had on one of his wives actually on the show.
I've seen this. Was he tall and thin?
Yes.
I think so. I have.
He went to prison. He went to prison because they actually have tapes of him assaulting these young girls in what he would call heavenly sessions in the temple. Disgusting. And there was actually a point, and they show it, where he's on a phone call with some of his followers on the other side. And he's like, I made it all up and I'm not really a prophet. And I just want to let you know. And they were like, oh no, of course you're the prophet. You're just having a weak moment. But there was a time where he fully admitted, he was like, sorry guys, my bad. And then 2 days later, or a couple days later, he was like, you're right. I was being led by the adversary and I just had a moment of weakness, but yes, I'm a prophet. And here's what God said. But there was a window, like a brief little moment where he admitted to it.
Yeah, he must have definitely been. Yeah, that must have definitely been an epiphany that he talked himself out of, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
That, because I don't think most of them get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Has he gotten out of prison, or they give him just a ton of time? He's going to die in prison.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Listen, you'd be shocked how many guys go to prison, pick up a Bible, and they're walking around preaching the Bible the whole time, and literally put the Bible down and walk out the front gates. Like, they just put it down and walk away. Like, it's like what they do. It's like they tell, like, oh, that's how he does his time. What do you mean? Yeah, he'll come and he'll read. Like, it's comforting for them while they're in prison to read the Bible and preach and learn about it. And then they get out and they just go right. They revert right back to who they were.
Yeah, I think it is a comfort for a lot of people, and people who aren't in prison, they find it comforting to. I don't, but if that's your thing, then that's great. If that makes you happy.
I remember there was a Bible laying like next to the garbage can one time, or it was actually sitting in the, it was one, they had like a platform around the garbage, and it was sitting right by the hole. And somebody goes, oh, somebody throw out a Bible. And somebody else goes, one of the Christians must have left. And I mean, I was started laughing like, oh my God. And he goes, it's true though. You ever noticed that? And I was like, oh, that's horrible. but well, listen, I'll look, I do think I've seen this, the keep sweet and obey. I do think I've seen this, but yeah. I'll look at it. My wife watch it with me. Okay. Well, I mean, anything else you want to cover? Are you good? How do you feel?
Yeah, I feel pretty good. I think we covered a lot of ground, a lot of the crazy Mormon history, a bit of my story. I was interested to hear about your story and some of the things that you've experienced. So we've covered a lot, I think.
Well, what, how long ago did you start your channel?
It's been a little over a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. And what are you doing now? Is this other than being pregnant?
Other than, yeah, I could give birth at any time. Yeah, I've just been working on the channel. So before I started the channel, I was doing wardrobe costuming for television shows and commercials here in LA, as well as doing the acting thing commercially. So when the strike happened, which was last year, last April-ish, I actually got married in April. So I took some time off and then there was no work. And I was like, let's just double down on the channel. So we started putting out 2-3 videos a week instead of just one. Everything blew up. There was just so much success with it. We were really surprised and it was great. People wanted to hear more. And so we've just been doing that full time ever since. And now that I'm pregnant and I could go into labor anytime, once baby comes, we'll just take a month or so off, but we've been front loading a whole bunch of videos so that the channel can continue on without us while we take a little break.
Well, I was going to say Aaron's channel is massive, right? Like he does great.
Yeah, he's doing really well.
Do you do lives?
We do. Aaron is like the king of lives.
He is.
We go live not every day like Aaron does, but he actually gave us some really good tips in the beginning. I think we had him on the channel when we were around 8,000 subscribers or something. And I mean, now we're, I think, at around 173,000. So we've definitely grown quite a bit pretty fast. But yeah, Aaron, we've loved watching his channel grow. He passed the 200. You just hit 200, right? So congrats on that.
Yeah. Yeah. To actually woke up this morning, it was too little.
Oh, this morning. Yay. Yeah. It takes a lot of work. And so I can definitely appreciate from a fellow creator's perspective, how much effort it takes to do that. So congrats.
Thank you. It was funny is when we passed like 100,000 and like got the plaque, mm-hmm. when I would hear people say, oh bro, you got to get your plaque. You got to get your plaque. Then this was before I just started the channel. I just remember thinking that's so silly. Like, I'm going to get, what do I care about the plaque? And then I got the plaque and I was like, I earned this. Like,
it's pretty cool, right? Ours is back there. Well, you can't see it because the screen is cut off, but it is back there.
But it is an accomplishment, right?
It is.
So, I do so many things now that 3 or 4 years ago, I just shrugged off and thought were ridiculous and silly. And now, now the same things that these other guys I know that have channels worry about. And I would just think, what are you, that's silly. Now I'm constantly checking the comments and checking this and checking the analytics and doing this. And it's like, I can't believe I'm doing this. I tell my wife, I'm like, hey, you know, that video got like 20,000 views in the first 24 hours. Like, that's really good. And she's like, yeah, okay. That's great, buddy. And then she just, shrugs it off. She could care less at this point. So
yeah, well, it does take a lot of work. And I imagine because you are an intelligent guy and you can figure out how to cheat the system, cheat the YouTube algorithm.
No, I know people that like pay for subscribers.
Oh, really?
I think the YouTube algorithm, I think that it's too sophisticated to to play that game.
Yeah.
You know, I think that people that do that, I think it catches up with you eventually.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's going to know suddenly you paid and you pumped out, you know, 50,000 views in 24 hours. And it's like, stop it. And it knows where these come from. These are bots or these are made up accounts. And I think YouTube will figure that out and be like, you know what? We're going to ban this guy's channel or I'm too scared.
I think I misspoke. What I meant to say was learn all of the trade secrets and do it the right way, as in learning all this, the secrets to boost your channel and do it in a way that doesn't technically cheat YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, this is the easiest job. This is, you know, I was interviewed by Lex Fridman.
Oh, great.
About whatever, a month ago. Like, no, not maybe 2-3 weeks ago. And it's funny because he cut this out of the interview. We were talking about like, what are you doing now and stuff. I remember at one point I said, listen, bro, I said, honestly, I go, I know we make this sound like it's like a real job. And he goes, right. And I said, this is a fucking joke though, right? Like all I do is talk to people.
Yeah.
Like I have to do that on a regular basis anyway. I just hit the record button. I go, I mean, what a joke is this? This is, and he goes, it is a joke. Cut it out of it. He cut it out. I remember thinking, oh, it'd be pretty cool if he put that in there. No, he was like, click, click.
Yeah, that's funny. I check myself all the time because, you know, it is tiring. Well, especially with the work that we do specifically, we're having heavy conversations with people. It's not just regular everyday stuff. We're hearing traumatic things. So it can be a little heavy and the editing takes time. But at the end of the day, I'm like, this is great. I just have conversations and people enjoy it. And now I can make a living making more than I did doing union wardrobe in Hollywood. So it's great. I'm really thankful that I'm able to do it, that I'm able to have a platform to prop people up and have them tell their stories and change lives. It's, you know, making a difference. And that's extremely rewarding, even more than the money.
Well, and periodically, I'm sure you still pick up acting gigs or, you
know, yeah,
you still
yeah.
do stuff. So,
yep.
What's great is it's not like you can't, like, I have to ask my boss for the day off.
Exactly.
Talking about Tuesday. Yeah, I can be there. I work for myself. I'll be there Tuesday. No problem.
Yes. So nice.
Well, listen, I appreciate you talking with me and telling me your story, telling me what you're doing now and chit-chatting. The name of the channel is Cults to
Consciousness.
Yes. It's on YouTube. Is it also on Spotify and all the other platforms? And
yeah, we don't put them up as soon as they release because I'm a little bit lazy on the podcast side. But but yes, we do post it on all of the podcasting sites as well.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, you know, I don't know if you know this, but you know, Spotify, you can upload the videos now.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I mean, we do have separate bumpers that we put for our audio, but I don't know. We're looking to change all of that. So maybe I'll look into that. That would be a good option.
Hey, I appreciate you guys watching the video. Do me a favor. If you liked it, please subscribe. Please hit the bell so you get notified of videos just like this. Share the video if you liked it and if you think anybody can benefit from it. Also, please, please check out the YouTube channel from Cults to Consciousness. And we're going to leave the link in the description box. So you can just go to the link, go to the description box and click it and it'll bring you right there. Thank you very much, you guys. I appreciate it. See ya.